If Scott Rasmussen's name sounds familiar, it's because he's the Rasmussen on the political poll of the same name, the poll with the best record in the business when it comes to translating public opinion into actual political results. Mr. Rasmussen has a new book out called In Search of Self-Governance, which probably sounds a little odd to a lot of Americans, Mr. Rasmussen, because, don't we assume that we have self-governance already?
Well, that's certainly the American heritage. It's the way that we were taught things were. In fact, we were brought up to believe that governments derive their only just authority from the consent of the governed. But right now in America, only 21% of Americans think that, in fact, our government has that consent. And Americans are united in the belief that our political system is broken, most politicians are corrupt, and the party leaders from both sides are clueless about what the country needs.
I recall that shortly after our military went into Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein, I recall an Iraqi man asking an American soldier, "Who's going to tell us what to do now?" And that sounded strange to American ears, that there would be actually a hunger for somebody to give them orders, but... Are we getting closer to that situation than maybe we would like to admit?
Well, you know, we certainly don't want to have people giving us orders. In fact, one of the main premises in the book is that the American people don't want to be governed from the left or the right. It's not a question of are we a center-right nation or anything else. The American people do want to govern themselves, but that sense is that a political elite that hangs around Washington and Wall Street is really... putting self-governance under assault. And part of the reason for it is we all slip into the mistake of thinking that governing America is simply the process of politics and government. In fact, the true self-governance, you know, starts with the fact that the most important decisions are made by individuals about their faith, their family, their jobs. We get together in communities and do things. And if we rely on the actions of the individual Americans, we end up with a much healthier system than with anybody trying to tell us what to do, in the words that you quoted earlier.
Your business, of course, is learning and evaluating public opinion. Talk to us about the dissatisfaction you find in this country today, the stuff that is most bothering the most people.
You know, it's hard to overstate the level of dissatisfaction. 75% say they're angry at the policies of the government. It's easy to point to some things that have fueled this fire in the last couple of years. The bailouts are overwhelmingly unpopular. A number of other issues, such as the takeover of General Motors, very unpopular. Deficits, huge issue. That has become a bigger and bigger problem for the Obama administration. But those things sort of miss the point. Those are the things that lit this version of the fire. But what they really symbolize is a broken system that we're supposed to be in a place where when companies do well, they profit, and when they do poorly, they go out of business. And most Americans look at our government today and say, they want us to play by those rules. They want churches and individuals and small businesses to play by those rules. But when the big boys get in trouble, well, they don't go out of business. They get bailed out by the taxpayers. And that's more than a dollar and cents concern. It's a sense of a fundamental corruption of the way our system is supposed to work.
Have the two major political parties, and I get this sense from following the polling on the Rasmussen website, but have the two major parties both pretty much lost the confidence of Americans, a majority of the population?
Absolutely. And, you know, you can look at polling data to see it. You can also look at election returns. In 2006 and 2008, people voted against the party in power. So then a new party came into power. And guess what? In 2009 and in Massachusetts last month, people voted against the party in power. That's what they're going to do later this fall, it looks like, from the early polling. If you go back a little bit further, in 1992, Bill Clinton was elected with a majority of Democrats in Congress. He lost control of Congress during his administration. George Bush was elected then with a majority of Republicans in Congress, and he lost Congress. That's never happened before in back-to-back administrations in our country's history. And that really signals to me that there is a pretty significant rejection of both parties. And I think the reason it gets right back to core beliefs. The people in Washington think their job is to provide the answers for us, and it's simply they want more people on their team than the other team can rule over us. Most Americans are saying no. The government, it's important. I mean, we can't deny the government has an important role to play in a self-governing society, but it's a support role, not the lead role.
Our history, of course, is replete with examples of how the majority has swung back and forth, the pendulum swinging back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. But are they both minority parties now? I mean, when I look at polling showing the Tea Party way up there and outnumbering support for the Republican Party, it looks like the majority party is nobody. Is that about right?
Well, it is. I think there's a different way of looking at it. You may recall there was a little football game in Miami a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And we polled ahead of time and found that 54% of people were rooting for the New Orleans Saints. They really weren't all Saints fans. Some of them were fans of other teams in the NFC. Some of them just had to pick a team. They liked the Drew Brees story. But very few of them were deeply committed to the Saints and want the Saints to repeat as Super Bowl champions. When Barack Obama was elected, he won with 53% of the vote. They weren't all deeply committed Barack Obama fans. Some of them thought Hillary Clinton should have been in the job. Some of them were saying, as long as it's not John McCain, that's okay. Some thought the tax cuts for 95% of Americans was a good thing. So we tend to have a much more fragmented party. But, you know, again, when we talk about it in election terms, we're still missing part of the story. If you go back throughout our history, almost all of the really significant things that took place outside of the world of politics, and Congress got around to ratifying it years later. You know, women weren't given the right to vote by Congress. Women were voting in the United States for 50 years before Congress got around to ratifying it. In fact, a woman was serving in Congress and introduced a resolution to allow women to vote in the rest of the states and basically dared her colleagues to vote against it before it became a federal law. It wasn't a political process in the way that we understand it. It was much more of a movement, a change of attitudes around the country.
We have talked about polling methodology before, and I've talked about it any number of times on the air, but still the questions recur. When I quote your polling, which we regard as the standard, I will inevitably get emails from listeners saying, but this or that poll, usually one of the media polls, you know, CBS, ABC, Washington Post, one of those polls, and the people will email and say, wait a minute, that poll has an entirely different result. How do you explain that? Would you take just a minute to explain the difference between your polling method and some of the more widely used methods?
Well, there's a lot of differences. The most basic methodology difference is that we have an automated system that makes the calls, whereas some of the other firms still use an operator-assisted technology. But beyond that, we tend to poll likely voters. Many of the media polls that are widely cited tend to poll only adults. And the difference there is if you poll only adults, you get a result that's going to be about 5 points more favorable to a Democratic candidate or to the president's approval ratings than if you poll likely voters. It's just a fact of the world that younger folks who are more sympathetic to Democrats right now are less likely to show up and vote. The other thing that comes up, and this is something I try to point out to people all the time, when polls have different results, the first thing I do is I look for the common ground. A great example took place in the healthcare debate. The Washington Post came out with a poll one time saying, oh, there's overwhelming support for the public option. And we had just released a poll showing there was opposition to it. If you looked in the details, you found that both of us had virtually the same results when we asked about the plan working its way through Congress. So you could safely say that that was a pretty good opinion. Almost all the polls taken showed the plan going through Congress was unpopular. When you began to look at the details on the differences, A lot of it had to do with question wording, and that tells me when you get a wide variety of answers with a modest change in question wording, that people aren't really settled on that issue or focusing on it very much.
The Democrats are clearly in disfavor now with a lot of people, but that doesn't seem to have translated into a huge increase in support for Republicans, does it?
Absolutely not. The biggest difference between now and 1994 is that in 1994, nobody could remember when the Republicans in charge. People were safe in assuming they couldn't possibly be any worse. Right now, people do remember when the Republicans ran Congress, and for many, including conservatives, it's not a pleasant memory. Nationwide, only 56% of conservative voters consider themselves Republicans. And that's one of the issues that continues to play out. A lot of talk these days, will the Republicans win the Senate or the House? My question is, do they really want to gain control? I'm not sure they have a game plan for going forward.
What about the rise of the Tea Party, which doesn't even exist as a formal, structured political party at all? Is that part of the attraction, the fact that there is no so-called party establishment?
Absolutely. I think one of the great things about the Tea Party movement is there are no leaders. People in the political framework keep trying to say, oh, who's the leader of the Tea Party movement? Is it Sarah Palin? Is it somebody else? Well, no, it's really not. Individual leaders may come and go, and popular figures may win support from time to time, but it is a group of people who are frustrated with the way that things are. And by the way, you know, the American people are quite pragmatic and are quite capable of making tough decisions when they're presented with reasonable choices. And the Tea Party movement is a reflection of that. Lots of diversity within the Tea Party members. Different people would say different things are important. But I think the larger message is it's that frustration with a political elite in Washington that is driving it.
It's clear that the people who express their frustration through the whole Tea Party movement can influence the outcome of elections, but can they win elections on their own, meaning a candidate who comes out and says, I am not a Republican, I am not a Democrat, I am part of the Tea Party movement. Can somebody taking that stance defeat the established organizations of the two big parties?
You know, there will be Tea Party candidates who win primaries within the parties. It looked recently like Deborah Medina might actually beat Kay Bailey Hutchison for the second slot in Texas before she had a major gaffe on Glenn Beck's show. So can Tea Party candidates win in those circumstances? Absolutely. But, you know, there is something beyond a label that is required. And what it really comes down to is showing some level of respect for the voters, inviting them into the process. For the most part, you know, we have a sports bar nation. People have their favorite sports team. They have their favorite political team. They cheer for them. The politicians play them to win support on particular things. But there is no real connection. There is no sense that people have any input into the process. And if you compare it, say, to the New Deal era, Franklin Roosevelt, a lot of conservatives don't like him, don't like what he did, but, you know, he went to great lengths to make sure that his policies enjoyed broad popular support. He really trimmed what Social Security was going to be, took a lot of steps that a lot of his advisors didn't like because he was trying to build that popular consent. And we don't have politicians trying to do that today. We have politicians saying, hey, elect me, I'll take care of it. They get in office, they want to ram things through, and this is true from both sides of the aisle, without really doing the hard work of building that popular support.
We'll be right back with Scott Rasmussen of the Rasmussen Poll, the Rasmussen Report Poll, and the author of the new book called In Search of Self-Governance. It's Hot Talk 560 KSFO. 24 minutes after 8, and OV has an update on the Bay Area commute.
Boy, howdy, we still have the heavy fog in most of the 9 Bay Area counties this morning. It affects the Bay Bridge. It affects areas, around the San Mateo Bridge. 92 westbound at Delaware, we've got an accident there, two cars involved. out San Mateo County farther, 280 southbound before Black Mountain Road, an accident involving several vehicles there. More in the South Bay, this would be San Jose 280 northbound, the ramp to 87 southbound, an accident there. And Santa Rosa, 12 westbound at Farmers Lane. We got something in the roadway there. It's an accident. No further details on that one. And this is brought to you by the business team at Chase, where you get the security of free.
You're listening to Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
With Scott Rasmussen of the Rasmussen Reports polling organization and the author of In Search of Self-Governance, you devote part of the book to concern about or contempt for the alliance between big government and big business. Elaborate. Give us an example or two.
Well, first of all, and this is actually a good place to mention it, the book is based on what I've been seeing in the polls over the past 15 years, but we don't get into a lot of polling statistics. So I don't mention in the book that 70% of Americans think there is an alliance between government and big business and that they tend to work together against the rest of us. But that's part of the, you know, the consensus view in America today. And it really gets to this core idea that there is an elite. They drift back and forth between a corporate suite and a position in government. Sometimes they're regulating the companies. Sometimes they are on the company side talking with their friends who are trying to regulate them. And what it leads to is a situation where these companies, some of these largest companies, find it easier to buy protection from the government than they do to serve their customers, than they do, and they really want protection from the free market forces that that have ruled the country for a long time. And there's lots of ways to look at it, lots of frustration out there. I think the simplest example is it's not a choice between regulating a company and deregulating a company. It's a choice between who's doing the regulation, a government regulator or consumers. And there is absolutely no doubt in the world that if consumers are empowered to provide that regulatory effect, they're much tougher than any government bureaucrat.
Would one example be of the big business alliance with big government? Would one example be found in, let's say, for example, a monster financial institution, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, one of those, and the Obama administration right now?
Absolutely. In fact, the entire bailout process dealing with a lot of financial institutions provided that same situation. We see the same thing with General Motors right now. There are companies that find it easier to deal with the government than to deal with consumers. And ultimately, the taxpayers get stuck with the bill, and it is a cause of great frustration. And it's much deeper, again, than just the dollars that are spent. This goes right against the grain of what Americans were brought up to believe. If a company can't serve the customers, they should go out of business. It's been happening for a couple hundred years, and it will keep happening, if we restore a self-governing society.
Isn't it odd that after all the ranting about Wall Street tycoons and their greed, President Obama had no problem with the top people in those financial institutions getting huge multi-million dollar bonuses just within the past couple of weeks? That kind of speaks to that same alliance, doesn't it?
It sure does. I mean, let's face it. If those companies hadn't been bailed out, we wouldn't be talking about their bonuses because they'd be gone. Those people wouldn't have jobs. If they were qualified, they'd have found a job somewhere else. And it's also important to point out, Americans don't mind if a person is successful and they get a big business, a big bonus, and it's privately paid for. That's not their concern. But when it's paid for on the taxpayer dollar because of bailouts and this regulatory system, that is offensive.
You advocate in the book increased awareness, political awareness among Americans. That's fine, but do you get the impression that the problems this country is facing now, the enormous debt and deficits, it's all just so big and so complex, most people would rather just throw up their hands and not even try to think about it?
You know, I actually think people are dealing with it in different ways. One of the examples I give in the book is on Social Security. It is frustrating to deal with it in the political process because it just becomes a political football. So So the American people are dealing with it separately. An entire generation or more now has been brought up to plan for their retirement without counting on Social Security. They are, you know, they're making those plans. Some of them may end up retiring a little bit later. Some may want to retire a little bit later. Some may set aside more than they had planned to. But they are taking steps to address the Social Security problem in their own life. And what that will do for the nation is, over time, Social Security will become easier to solve because people won't be counting on it so much. You know, it's not a grand political solution. It's not something that a member of Congress can stand up and say, oh, boy, I did this. I guarantee you that sometime, a generation or so from now, some Congress will pass a Social Security reform. They will take credit for saving lots of money. But the real groundwork will have been done by those individuals who are planning for their own retirement without Social Security.
The book by Scott Rasmussen is called In Search of Self-Governance. And, of course, we follow the Rasmussen poll, as you know, every day on this program. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, and we'll talk to you again soon.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's Hot Talk 560 KSFO. 833. Is there something going on in Austin, Texas? A small plane flew into a building in Austin. The FBI is investigating, wondering, you know, could this be terrorist-related?
Huh.
And it may be just coincidence, but an earlier train derailment near Austin is also being investigated on the same basis.
Huh.
Is there something going on in Austin, Texas? We'll all have to keep an eye on this story all day long. It's Hot Talk 560 KSFO. Now with the latest on the stock markets, Big Buck joins us from the Wall Street Journal.
The Dow Jones Industrials up 15 points at 10,324. NASDAQ up 2, the S&P 500 up 1. The stock market has been trading in a tight range following reports new claims for unemployment benefits rose unexpectedly and inflation increased. Wholesale prices rose almost 1.5% in January due to double-digit increases in gasoline and home heating oil. Meanwhile, the Labor Department said first-time claims for unemployment benefits rose by 31,000 last week. A gauge of the U.S. economy's prospects 3 to 6 months down the road rose for the 10th month in January. More good news for home buyers and those wishing to refinance. Freddie Mac says the average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage dropped to 4.93% this week from last week's 4.97%. Crude oil up 1.5% at $78.55 a barrel, and the yield on the 10-year Treasury note 3.794%. Once again, the Dow up 17, NASDAQ up 2.5, the S&P up 1. I'm Buck McQuillan at the Wall Street Journal on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
Oh, a little bad blood between and among Democrats.
Oh.
You know, the president's been taking his shots at Las Vegas. Oh, you shouldn't go to Las Vegas and blow your money. He is going to Las Vegas today to make a campaign speech on behalf of Crazy Harry Reid. Mayor Oscar Goodman of Las Vegas is a Democrat. He has refused to accept an invitation to meet with President Obama today.
You're waking up with Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
If you know the Austin, Texas area, the building that the small plane crashed into is a 7-story office building in the 9400 block of Research Boulevard. That's the word from Austin fire officials.
Yeah.
And, well, there's a lot of smoke on
video.
A
lot of smoke coming out of there, yeah.
With the Masters Golf Tournament 7 weeks away, ESPN correspondent Tom Rinaldi explains what it would take for Tiger Woods to be ready to compete.
There have been reports that Woods hasn't played golf at all during this hiatus, but it's not unprecedented. He went through a stretch of time where he didn't hit very many golf balls, if any, after the death of his father. Still, I think a real tipping point will be if we see him at Doral and or Bay Hill. If he doesn't appear there, I wouldn't expect him at Augusta, and if not there, I think it'll be a long time before we see Tiger Woods in a competitive venue.
And the question hanging over today's revelation, whatever it is, by Tiger is whether or not Mrs. Tiger the lovely Elin will be showing up for the event. Ovi, you think she will?
I think she will. I think it's going to be one of those I support him even though he'd done me wrong moments.
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't think she'll be there.
Huh.
One of us will be wrong.
Then it's a pistol
tomorrow
duel.
Morning, pistols at 20 paces.
<That's right>.
Exactly. U.S. athletes picked off 6 medals at the Winter Olympics yesterday, 3 of them gold. ABC's Alex Stone, who gets all the good jobs, has a report from up there in Vancouver.
On the medal count, the U.S. is way up now thanks to what was a record-breaking day yesterday with a gold from Shaun White and a gold from Lindsey Vonn. The U.S. is now ahead with 14 medals. 5 of them are gold. Germany is in second place with 10 medals.
I still think that biathlon could be made more telegenic.
Yes.
If, you know, they ski and then they stop and shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Use paintball rifles and ski and stop and shoot at each other. It'd be a lot more exciting.
Sure.
To watch.
Using primary colors, boy, it would just jump out at you.
Great television. Mm-hmm. Great television. It's big government versus big business today as the Department of Health and Human Services takes on the insurance industry. ABC News' Jim Hickey has more.
As the cost of health care goes up, so must the cost of health care insurance. Even the government acknowledges that. But Health and Human Services says requested increases by insurance companies.
What?
He flatlined.
So did Jim.
Yeah.
So did Jim. You may have noticed we have been having audio difficulties today because we are computer dependent in that area, which was just a stupid mistake. Let's see. I have some of the verbatim on Jim's report.
Yeah.
Health and Human Services says the increases in rates requested by insurance companies, 25, 30, even more than 50%, are just way over the top. And the report says Americans are paying more and more for less and less and calls the health insurance system broken. Gee, does this sound like another backdoor pitch for government-run medical services?
No.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Heavens.
A big fine proposed against American Eagle Airlines, the small plane subsidiary of American, for what the government says was improper maintenance. We have a report from Lisa Stark.
The FAA is proposing a $2.9 million fine against American Eagle for flying more than 1,000 flights with 4 airplanes that had improper repairs to their landing gear doors. The FAA says the airline was supposed to remove the doors to make the repairs, but instead did them with the doors still attached to the planes. The airline then flew some 960 flights that way, and when it discovered the problem, continued to fly another 217 flights before fixing the doors properly. The airline will appeal the fine, says there was never a safety issue. Lisa Stark, ABC News, Washington.
President Obama wants new rules for Wall Street, and White House correspondent Ann Compton reports on who may be policing the regulations.
Who will blow the whistle on risky banking practices in the future? The answer seems to be the Treasury Department, not the independent Federal Reserve Board, which has gotten a lot of criticism for not stopping the risk-taking behavior that brought on the Wall Street crisis in the first place. Congress and the White House are coming to an agreement on a new council as a kind of early warning system to spot companies in danger.
Is your high school sophomore ready for college? Jim tells us about a new experimental program to determine earlier which kids are college-bound and which really aren't college material.
These aren't really 10th grade exams. They're exams that a student can take in the 10th grade.
And if they pass, go directly to college.
And get on with their life.
Mark Tucker, president of the National Center on Education and the Economy, says with a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, 8 states will take part in the program based on similar projects overseas.
Whether they want to be a carpenter or a brain surgeon.
Because the experiment is performance-based, Tucker says students will be better prepared for college and beyond.
Kids will know what they have to do.
Jim Hickey, ABC News.
Can you imagine what the unemployment numbers in this country would look like if all of those perpetual students who just seemed to be going to school forever, were actually out looking for actual jobs.
Oh, God.
Oh, and it's one reason the government likes to keep those student loans going and all that stuff. Keep them out of the unemployment figures. Sure. The White House is forecasting the number of new jobs will start growing by spring as the economy improves, they hope. Richard Davis looks at a couple of ways to get a job.
One way to find a job is to sign on as a temp worker.
About 40% of temp jobs, let alone internships, lead to full-time jobs.
Jennifer Openshaw with the careers website superfutures.org.
Look at it as a way for you to learn about that company. Do you really want to work there? And for you to demonstrate your know-how.
The number of temporary jobs is on the rise. Another way to boost your chances of getting a good job, look at your networks.
That's not only who you know, but who your friends know, your parents know, your friends' parents know.
Richard Davies, ABC News.
Campaigns underway to save the iconic Abbey Road recording studios in London. Linda Alban says one former Beatle has lent his support to keep it going.
Okay, go and freeze.
On the famous zebra stripe pedestrian crossing outside the Abbey Road studios here in London, the tourists can't resist recording walking in the Beatles' footsteps.
My son here, he loves the Beatles. And we promised him he came out to London to visit Abbey Road. He can walk across here. And go and freeze.
No wonder there's a campaign underway to save this musical piece of real estate, supported by former Beatle Paul McCartney, whose album of the same name helped give the studio its fame. EMI hasn't indicated whether the brand goes with the building, but the crossing will survive along with the music. Linda Alban, ABC News, London.
You're listening to Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
Huck and Rush are just ahead. In the show business news, Tuesday night's American Idol did very well. 23.6 million viewers, way ahead of the 19.7 million viewers for the Olympics coverage. How about that? On the celebrity birthday list today, one of the legendary singers...
It's got to be Yoko Ono.
It is Yoko Ono, the incomparable.
Yoko, gosh, she's something like 75?
77
yeah.
Today. And a woman of letters, mm-hmm. Vanna White.
Ah, Vanna. Let's put Vanna right there at 58.
53, but they've been hard years.
Yes.
And... well, he started out as a sweat hog, and look at him now. John Travolta.
Travolta, 60.
56.
I'm in the ballpark.
Let's go home and get some rest.